This is the PropTech VC Podcast. We give you unique insights into how innovative technologies are disrupting real estate. We interview top entrepreneurs, investors, and knowledgeable experts to share the inside scoop in this fast-moving industry. It's hosted by leading PropTech VC, Zane Jaffer. Let's dive into today's content.
That's when you take the Tesla approach and you invest in a lot of infrastructure that can be repurposed. Right. And in real estate too, there's temptations to just throw a bit of CapEx into this, keep the costs low, and then, you know, you're good. But sometimes the more you put into it, the better. I mean, if you go for the cheapest roof or the cheapest AC system, you're going to pay for that long term. And if you run your business very tactically, you'll always be in maintenance mode. On a technical level, right, companies that have technical initiatives they want to implement, there's a challenge, and being a product guy, I'm very curious to hear what you think. Product is one of those areas where it's not like sales, where you're judged basically on the revenue you bring in. You're judged on different metrics, but there's pressure to perform. And that means that there's pressure to go with something that produces immediate short-term results. If you take the average product or tech team, they want to make sure that, you know, 2-3 years from now, when they're interviewing at another company, if that's what they decide to do today, that's the way things are. You know, people don't stay very long at companies. They're able to say, oh, I implemented project X and I did XYZ. Now, that's a conflict with where the board or the management team might want to take the company. Companies are supposed to think long term, as you said, decades ahead. How do you handle that when you have a frontline team of product people, for example, who are under pressure to generate immediate results for their own CV? But also because that's how people judge them. A founder can say, I want 10-year results, but who's gonna get pat on the back? Not the tech guy who's saying, you know, I'm building infrastructure and, you know, the results will come in 3 years. It's someone who's gonna say, look, I immediately improved conversion rates. I immediately improved revenue by X. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think, like a lot of other things, a lot of it actually does come back to incentives. I mean, I think about how we solve this at a technology company, and a big part of it is, it might be trite, but is stock options, right? You incentivize your employees to think about the long-term value that they're generating. And when you give, and this is why companies do this in Silicon Valley, when you incentivize someone, when you make them an owner of your company, they're not just thinking about, hey, how do I make sure my paycheck keeps coming and I, you know, beef up my CV as fast as possible. They're thinking, how can I turn this into long-term value? How can I make this something that's maybe worth, you know, a cent a share today, but will be worth a couple dollars or, you know, tens of dollars a share down the road? And I do think that that's the kind of thinking that helped us at Zimride think about, you know, what other products do we want to launch? How do we get ourselves out of this box of just delivering on whatever feature request I was asked to deliver last week? And a big part of that is knowing that I was an owner in the company, and the same thing for my coworkers. So I think incentives are a big way, making sure that your team is really compensated both financially and from a, you know, career track promotion perspective, not just in the short-term things that they deliver, but in the long-term value that they create. And you want to reward, it's hard because you have to reward failure. Right. A big part of the Silicon Valley ethos is it's okay to fail, but fail fast. And I do think instilling that sense of a willingness to fail is super, super important. And one of the reasons that technology companies are so successful at reinventing themselves, because their employees are just constantly thinking about new ideas, and there's a culture of it's acceptable to fail. And so I think, you know, you can bring that to real estate, right? You can try a new type of deal as long as you can kind of unwind it. We talk a lot about kind of two-way doors and one-way doors in technology. As long as this is, you might not want to bet the entire company on a super risky thing, but you do want to make sure that people are empowered enough so that they can take those two-way doors. And it's up to the boss, you know, the CEO at the kind of the top of the pay scale to be deciding on one-way doors that you really can't back out of. You can't go the other way through, but your employees should be empowered to think about those two-way doors and to be, you know, throwing things at walls, seeing what sticks, experimenting, and then allowing you to double down in the long term on the things that produce good results.
Yeah, and I'd add to that, I think it's not necessarily celebrating failure, tolerating failure, obviously, but not focusing too much on the output, whether it's success or failure, on the process itself. You know, it's like raising a child. You don't want to tell the child you're really smart, you're really clever, or, you know, great job on getting a, you know, grade A, grade B. Right. Instead, you worked really hard. Great job. I like the effort you're putting in. Keep up with that, right? It's amazing how you can really... the words you say have a lot of power. Yeah. And, you know, for any listeners that have children, you can probably appreciate that too. What type of person do you want to incentivize in your child as they grow up? Do you want someone who's going to have a false sense of confidence, who thinks they're really smart and clever and then gives up at the first sign of trouble? Or do you want someone who's being totally reinforced and doing things like working hard and building those core values that are important? You know, core values are very important, and the words that management say have a big effect. Talking about Uber, for example, lots of things happen at Uber that were the result of frontline engineers interpreting what the management was saying. When management had very aggressive values, and, you know, we'll do whatever it takes to win, right? We're gonna declare war on everyone. You know, there was a moment, which is quite interesting, I'm sure you know a lot about this, where Uber did a few things that wouldn't necessarily be the type of things Lyft would do, you know, in terms of values, right? Then I know Lyft, I know the founders, and, you know, you get that sense, but Uber would do things like find the location of influential lawmakers, right? And, you know, basically target those people and show them things that aren't real, such as don't show them the true number of Ubers around. If they're trying to get an Uber, don't let them. There was a time when I think the city wanted to bust drivers and cite them. What does Uber do? Yep. They target those users. And when you are, it was the frontline employees were interpreting things. Yep. They got to a stage where, there was some third-party code Uber had integrated. I think it was called Do you know what it was called? Was it InAuth or whatever it was called?
I don't remember the name of it, but I know what you're talking about.
Either way, a frontline engineer basically figured out a way where there was some software Uber integrated, and it was there to prevent fraud because there were lots of people that were taking fake accounts in China and, you know, just taking money from Uber, right? So Uber integrated third-party code, hid it from Apple completely, and would deactivate it whenever a user near Cupertino, which is Apple's headquarters, would, you know, look at it, right? I think Travis didn't even know this was going on, but Tim Cook called, the founder of Uber, basically, and said, this is unacceptable. We've just discovered an employee that isn't in the Bay Area, in one of our remote offices, discovered that you've got this code. Yet when we try to do this at Apple HQ, we don't see the code. What's going on? And you know, this is the damage that you can have when you incentivize the wrong things. Winning at all costs, for example, as a value, is dangerous. And your employees will do that indeed.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, values are key. I mean, they're absolutely key to, you know, your company knowing what gets done. I like, you know, one of my favorite definitions of a company culture is what people do when they're not being told what to do. And I think, you know, Uber was a great example of the bad culture that can come from Silicon Valley. Of it's clear what was happening, you know, well, in those cases, maybe even people were being told what to do, but whether or not that was the case, you know, they acted aggressively, and at the end of the day, they were just trying to grow for growth's sake at whatever cost. They didn't really care. And they didn't care whether it crossed, you know, legal, moral boundaries, those kind of things. And I think it's, you know, we certainly saw ourselves very differently at Lyft, and we saw ourselves carrying the mantle of being the good guys in the fight and being a company that treats people well, that treats, you know, drivers well, that treats everybody well. I think one of the biggest differentiators I saw when I was there was our employees drove our employees drove for Lyft all the time. I've given thousands of rides on the platform. And I remember talking to a friend of mine that worked at Uber and mentioning that and asking, you know, do you, and this was in their days of, you know, Uber's a baller service. That's what we do. We make people feel baller. And I said, okay, well, have you ever driven? Have you ever gotten behind the wheel? And, you know, she kind of scoffed and said, ha, you're right. Are you kidding me? Like, I would never drive people around. And that kind of mindset of that lack of empathy, I think has really shown through. It shows through in the product. It shows through in, you know, everything that they've done. And I think Lyft's ability to empathize with drivers because our executive team, our entire team was full of drivers, really shown through in our product. And you see that with, you know, John Zimmer, the president of Lyft, like still gives rides. He doesn't do it all the time, I think, but he still gives rides like every New Year's. And you never saw Travis doing that. You saw videos instead of Travis, you know, getting in vehicles and berating drivers. And that was, I think, one of the key differences that I saw.
You know, when you zoom out, it seems quite easy, you know. Focus on what makes your company special,
yep.
That makes your product better, and that delights customers. I mean, I don't know how you can go wrong when you have, if you're Amazon and your core value is customer obsession, how can you screw that up? It may cost you a little bit to deliver, you know, obsessive customer experience, but ultimately, long term, decades out, no one can touch the quality of service Amazon provides. In the same way, if you're gonna just incentivize, we're gonna be the best, we're gonna be number one, we're gonna always win, well, ultimately, you're gonna get divorced from the core of what you exist. Don't forget, your job as a founder or an executive in a company is to deliver value, to deliver a product or service that someone sees value out of and will pay you for it. The moment you disconnect the payment and the value you're providing and you keep them separate, you'll start to do things like, I know Uber added like this, you know, $1 extra charge, right? I don't know what it was called, you know, for employees. Driver safety.
Trust and safety.
Trust and safety, right.
Yeah.
The money didn't go to trust and safety at all. It was just an extra way for Uber to boost margins, you know? So, and we're just talking about Uber here a lot just because of your background in Lyft. So, you know, just to make it relevant. But big case study here. You know, what you say and how you act goes a very long way.
Right. Yeah, and I think another part of it is just having a clear mission, right? You know, think about it this way, you know, at Parkade, our mission isn't easier parking. Our mission is to help the world operate with fewer parking spaces. And that's a really, really key difference. If all we care about is easier parking, we're probably going to have a lot of people using our product that wouldn't have been driving otherwise, that maybe they would have walked before, or maybe they didn't even own a car before, and we've just made parking easier for them. By really clearly understanding that our mission is to help the world operate with fewer parking spots, that drives us down a completely different goal track, a goal, you know, trajectory, and helps us get to a place where we're removing parking spaces from the world, where we're helping turn parking lots into housing.
And it's odd to hear that too, because I can't imagine when Bill Gates built Microsoft, his goal was to have fewer computers on the desk. His goal was to have computers on every desk. As a company that's trying to modernize tenant parking, why would you go with fewer parking spots? That just seems to be like the opposite of, you know, what's going to fuel growth. And I'm playing devil's advocate here. I see what you're trying to do. But help me understand how you crafted that mission. And it sounds sort of counterintuitive or contradictory even to growth. Fewer parking spaces is bad for you.
It's not bad for us, because a lot of what we want to do is help bring market forces to parking. There's the way we have built parking spaces in the United States is to just massively overbuild them and then deploy them super inefficiently with typically a price of $0, right? More than 90% of the time someone parks in the United States, I actually think it's more than 97%, they are not paying a dime to park, at least not directly. Someone is always paying indirectly. Parking is never free. It's just often not paid for by the user. And that has led, that among other things, along with, you know, government regulations and all kinds of things, has led to a state of affairs where we have 2 billion parking spaces in the United States, and we only have about 2 billion, we only have about 300 million cars. So by default, we have deployed a super inefficient resource. Imagine if housing was like that, right? Imagine if we had 1 billion housing units, you know, or 2 billion housing units in the country for 300 million people. That would be ungodly inefficient, and it would be a massive waste of resources, and you'd be paying, you know, a massive amount more for your housing as a result. I don't see it as conflicting, because if I can create a world with, you know, 1 billion parking spaces for 300 million cars, but they are, you know, priced properly and easy to access. That is a much better world, both for us as a company, because we're hopefully managing all those spots, but it's also a better world we've created for property owners, for cities, for people that, you know, don't want to have to own cars, all that kind of stuff.